Good afternoon. Thank you so much for being here. We are so excited about this day and to have you still here at this point for a wonderful conversation. I was asked to moderate, but I want you to know that this is not a debate. Barbara and Sam and I'm Frances Rust. I'm the new dean at Erickson. Sam and Barbara and I spent some time last week outlining areas that we might talk about today. What we're going to do is, it's starting to hum again. What we're going to do is begin with several questions that we thought we could have a good conversation about, and then we will turn it over to you because I know you will have things that you want to talk with them about too. So we're going to begin with a discussion of developmentally appropriate practice. It's one of those big words now, or a small word, DAP, in the early childhood field. And it has gone through a number of iterations and meanings, and so we thought it might be useful for Barbara and Sam to weigh in on the way we ought to think about that at this point in time. So I think we'll begin with Barbara.
You start with me? I'm probably the best person to start with because I was in on the beginning of developmentally appropriate practice. We dreamed it up the year I was president of the National Association for the Education of Young Children, primarily because the kindergartens in those days were practicing what we would call then and we would still call push-down curricula, where the first-grade curricula was being pushed into the kindergarten, and the kindergartens were trying to push it into the preschool. And we felt very strongly that there is a domain of curricula that is appropriate for children who are under 6 or 7, and that we needed to make sure that everybody knew what it was. And the first iteration of developmentally appropriate practice came in a green book. Maybe some of you are old enough to remember the green book. It was comparable to the little red book. But
about 1987?
About 1987. Earlier than that. 1978, maybe. Very early. And we made what was, I have learned since, is the one mistake you should never make, and that is to think that you could change something once you started. What we did wrong was to say, well, you know, a lot of people really won't understand what this means if we just use the words. Children ought to play, children ought to initiate their own activities, things like that. People really won't understand what we mean. So we should have a series of examples. This is developmentally appropriate, this is not. And we had examples like filling in worksheets is not developmentally appropriate, playing with unit blocks is. Well, what happened was that the examples became developmentally appropriate. That's what developmentally appropriate was. It was rigid. It was no longer tied to principles, but began to have a life of its own. Some of us were really quite distressed about this life of its own. And then in 1987, that's when the second iteration came on. One of the serious concerns I certainly had, and others joined me, that it implied that if you didn't do these normative things that were in the developmentally appropriate list, there was something wrong with you. Well, clearly children who came from different cultural backgrounds, children who came from different social classes, didn't know and didn't do the kinds of things that had been listed as developmentally appropriate. And I believe the silent dialogue, Lisa Delpit, was one of the people who brought forth the fact that by making developmentally appropriate a rigid set of do's and don'ts, we were essentially cutting off large numbers of children and implying there was something wrong with them. And so the second iteration of developmentally appropriate practice was born in 1987. Sue Bradykamp, as you probably know, was the initiator of it and has been the interpreter of it really ever since. You'll be relieved to know another iteration is in the makings, and NAYC will be producing another developmentally appropriate practices that takes into account even more of the new knowledge than we had in 1987. The history, I think, is important because as we meet people who talk about developmentally appropriate practices, it is mostly they're saying, this is developmentally appropriate, that is not developmentally appropriate. And I think our intent was that we would have a set of principles that were developmental, and from those you would then decide for individual children as well as for groups of children what was appropriate. I think that we have now gotten to the point where if, for instance, you don't have play every day, free play every day, it's not developmentally appropriate. And one of the concerns I have is how we structure the day for children who are only in center-based programs for 2.5 hours as opposed to 8 hours or 12 hours. And is developmentally appropriate the same for all those children, I think is one of the questions that we have to ask. Or what is developmentally appropriate for children who are in programs for differing periods of time as well as children who come from different cultural backgrounds? I'm going to let you talk a little bit about what you see as the major issues.
I want to start by saying that there are two topics I will not discuss at all. Alaska and Joe the Plumber. Not that clear. On the other hand, one of the most amazing things about developmentally appropriate practice that has stuck with me over the years is I now have really completely lost touch of the years that when these two editions came out. I actually think we're off by a decade, but whatever it is, it's a long time ago. So it was some long time ago that I was giving a talk on assessment of all things in Seattle or somewhere like that. And it was at a big hotel, and so there was this big early childhood conference. And I noticed there was also a conference on that was set up for secondary school principals. And then I saw a lot of these people come out of a room, out of the secondary school principals conference, and they were all holding binders. And I noticed on the binders it said, developmentally appropriate practice. And that simply blew my mind. So that DAP had made its way up to high school, whatever it meant for them, I cannot tell you. But I will say that, you know, that I think the influence really did come from early childhood. Again, I don't know what it meant, but we've heard presidential candidates talk about developmentally appropriate practices in preschool. And some of them, we've even heard some presidents who are not very developmentally appropriate themselves who have done this. So maybe all that is to say that this expression, developmentally appropriate, means a lot of different things to different people. And now, on the one hand, that makes sense. Education is dynamic. Children are dynamic. What we know about children changes very, very dramatically. I had the privilege of serving on a committee that Barbara chaired at the National Academy of Sciences that released the report Eager to Learn in 2001. And one of the things we did in that report was to review new research and to show how far things had come in over the previous decade or so, and that there were now things that we could expect children to learn and that we can teach children, very young children, preschoolers, that previously we thought would be impossible or maybe at best we would have thought would be developmentally inappropriate. So there is change. On the other hand, I do believe there are things that don't make any sense for young children. That we can walk into a classroom, and most of us here would agree that the practice that we're seeing is practice that should not take place, whatever label we assign to it, developmentally inappropriate or unhealthy for young children, any number of labels of that sort. So that places us in this, I think, difficult position. Where how can we do what you tried to do at the very beginning, Barbara, with DAP, which is to say, this is developmentally appropriate, this is not. I think that sharp contrast is almost impossible to draw, because in some circumstances it may even be right to do a worksheet, okay? Only in some circumstances for a little bit of time with a certain kid at a certain way, right? All right. We'll modify that. But all right. But you may want to do it, all right? But so it's very difficult to say this is always wrong, harming children, hurting children. I'll say that's always wrong. But there are some things, you know, about our curriculum. It's hard to say that always wrong or always right, and yet. We do want to teach people where to go and how to structure a curriculum, how to structure time with children so that it is meaningful and that it advances development. And I think that's been the purpose of the DAP. There will be a new DAP that's going to be released next month. It'll be interesting to see what kind of advances and changes are there. But this remains, I believe, one of the paradox. It's not a paradox. It's really one of the challenges for our field, to constantly absorb the change that's there and yet have strong principles that will tell us that this is sensible to do with kids and this is not.
I think, you know, Sam, bringing up just a really important point that somehow or another, there is an anchor. I think I talked a good deal about the flexibility and the differences among children and among groups of children. But there needs to be an anchor for what is appropriate and what is not appropriate for little kids. And I spent a good deal of last year roaming around the world and going to Singapore and seeing children who were 3 years old learning English and Mandarin, and learning to read and write in English and Mandarin at the same time, and all perfectly fluent in their home languages. And we're concerned about teaching one language. The point that I want to make is that there's an enormous flexibility in what children can and cannot learn. And for us to be tied down by a Piagetian notion that there's some arbitrary limit to what kids can learn, I think is a mistake. On the other hand, I do think we have to anchor it. And so what do we anchor it with? And at this point, and I might change my mind tomorrow, but at this point it seems to me that we anchor it in what we would call early learning standards, that we decide arbitrarily that this is what kids ought to know and be able to do. We admit that it's arbitrary. There's nothing cast in concrete about it. But if it's going to fit in with the sequence of learning in our schools, if it's going to fit in with the kind of needs we have for educated people in our society, then those are our learning standards and that's our anchor. And then we can begin to think, well, how do we help individual children reach those criteria? How do we help groups of children reach those standards? So when I, you know, if you'd asked me 10 years ago, do I believe in learning standards, I would, for little kids? And how about 0 to 3? Do you believe in learning standards for 0 to 3? I would have said no. I'm becoming more of a advocate for learning standards if we think about them as kind of the anchor of what children need to know and be able to do. Arbitrary, then we can go back and build up. What is the prior knowledge children need to have if we want them to do this when they're in kindergarten, if we want them to do that when they're in first grade?
Well, I've been there. I'm totally there. When I wrote my dissertation, which was a few years ago, it was about teacher decision-making in open classrooms. And teachers have reasons for what they do. They may not know those reasons consciously, but if you work at it, you can get people to say what that is. And those can be formalized in terms of standards from birth onwards. So I'm a strong believer in standards. But then there are some standards that I would never, ever consider putting into my set of standards because I think that they're inappropriate. So then we come back full circle to this question of how do you decide that?